Welcome to ASA Central Line, the official podcast of the American Society of Anesthesiologists, edited by Dr. Adam Stryker.
Welcome to another episode of Central Line. I'm your host and editor, Adam Stryker. Today, we're going to do the first of what I hope will be a series of episodes on the topic of diversity in anesthesiology, aimed at understanding where we're at and how we can improve. My guest today is Dr. Antonio Hernandez-Conti. Dr. Hernandez-Conti, who currently serves as a partner with Kaiser Permanente's Southern California Medical Group, has been a trailblazer on diversity issues, and we're happy to have him here with us today to help us start excavating this important topic. Dr. Hernandez-Conti, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Dr. Stryker. It's a pleasure to be here, and I'm happy to be involved in this new endeavor.
Well, why don't we start off by having you tell us a little bit about yourself and your background?
Well, I think as we start to excavate this whole topic of diversity, equity, and inclusion, it's really important to understand that everybody has their own unique set of perspectives. And a lot of that really comes into play as we start to learn about people such as myself and others who will be part of these podcasts. So I am the product of a Mexican-American first-generation father and a mother who was Ethiopian Italian and born and raised in Ethiopia. So right off the bat, ethnically and racially, I'm quite diverse. When you first meet me, you're not quite sure, you know, what I am. Some people might think I'm Asian. Some people think I'm Latinx. Some people think I'm, Middle Eastern. So my racial and ethnic background is quite unusual. My father was in the U.S. military. And so we traveled all over the world for the majority of my childhood and ended up in Jacksonville, Florida, as I was completing junior high and then was able to attend and complete high school. So in many ways, I sort of look upon Jacksonville, Florida as my hometown, but my family has roots in Texas and my father currently resides in San Antonio.
You've had a multi-ethnic background and you're openly gay. Has that affected your career in anesthesia?
First of all, ironically, my being Mexican American or Mexican Ethiopian Italian didn't really seem to come into play for a large portion of my life. I think because of my background of having been a military kid, most people who are in the U.S. military tend to think of themselves as Americans first and kind of, you know, their ethnic origin or their race sort of really tends to play a more secondary kind of role. When you're living overseas, people say, "Where are you from?" And you say, "I'm from the United States of America." So for most of my, you know, formative years, you know, I really just considered myself an American with kind of, you know, an unusual ethnic background like many other military families. It became pretty apparent in my early teens that I was gay. Although we never really used that word in the early 80s, when I was in junior high and high school, certainly, you know, most people around me could sort of figure out that there was something a little different about me. And I openly came out when I was in college, and I intentionally sought out a college in the Northeast that was extremely liberal, where I could openly, you know, go through the process of dealing with being a homosexual, which at that time was not an easy feat. It's certainly not like today where there is much, much less stigma and much fewer barriers. It was very difficult to do. So I intentionally looked for a place such as Brown University, where I ended up going to college, really outside of my geographic region, outside of my circle of friends. And at that point, I really began to sort of go down a path where I intentionally, you know, looked for mentors who were either underrepresented in science and technology or people who were, like myself, openly gay. It really took a while for me to find my place, I think, in that paradigm. Luckily at Brown, one of the things that really attracted me to Brown was that they had a specific pipeline program that identified people who had an interest in medicine and interested in science, and they really wanted to improve the representation of Blacks, Latinos, Latinx, and Native Americans in the medical structure. So that program was really instrumental to me becoming exposed to sort of the world of medicine, but more importantly, it really provided an infrastructure for me to succeed. It identified mentors that I could work with who would sort of endorse me, so to speak, so that I fell into a more protected sphere at Brown. I think coming from a public high school in the South, I was somewhat naively surprised by exactly how different it would be to be attending an Ivy League institution where certainly my race and my sexual orientation and my background started to really become quite glaringly obvious to other people. And I had just sort of taken it for granted. As I proceeded and graduated from Brown, I was an openly gay man living life pretty openly. I arrived at the Boston University School of Medicine in 1987. And all of a sudden, the situation was extremely different. And I had to go back into the closet, so to speak. For those of you who may remember, 1987 was pretty much the beginning of the peak of the AIDS epidemic. And society at that point really identified gay men with AIDS. So the two were one and the same as far as most people were concerned. So really there was a huge stigma to being openly gay. And many people, you know, advised me not to reveal it, not to talk about it, just kind of lay low and do your work and get through med school and not worry about it. I was also dealing with a lot of racial discrimination being in Boston during that same time. Boston was extremely segregated in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. There were a lot of obstacles for people of color. In my medical school class, there were very few people who were underrepresented minorities in medicine. And, you know, it was really a difficult experience, I think, compared to Brown, where I had an infrastructure, I had a support network. Medical school was extremely difficult for me. I think due to the stigma of being gay and it being associated with HIV and AIDS, you know, I really was dealing with a lot of, I think, negative perception. The issue of race just added another very large, overwhelming aspect to this. And it really was a difficult time for me. There were multiple students in my medical school class who were from underrepresented groups in medicine, and very few of us graduated on time. And I think we all sort of shared the same feelings that we really didn't have an infrastructure. We didn't have any mentorship. We didn't really have a safe space to, you know, talk about our feelings or to express the difficulties we were encountering. And some of those were related to being Latinx or Black or being a woman or being a gay man. It was sort of a combination of all of those things. So despite all that, by the end of residency, I actually did kind of come back out of the closet and declare myself because I just felt it was important for me to be true to myself.
So where did you go to residency?
So when I was transitioning to from medical school to anesthesiology residency, I was really looking for a place that would be a lot more supportive. I very fortunately ended up at Yale for my anesthesiology residency, and it was a completely different environment. It was a 180-degree change from being in Boston. I think, first of all, the atmosphere within the department at Yale was more like a family. They were extremely open in the way they approached students and residents. They were extremely open about how they asked you about your social life, if you had a significant other. There were a lot of little sort of very small clues that sort of just alerted me to the fact that it was a great place to sort of start to, you know, train and begin my life in anesthesiology. I've spoken about the concept of having a mentor or not having a mentor. And probably one of the most pivotal things towards my being successful at Yale during my anesthesiology residency was having two very important mentors. And these are people who I think many people in anesthesiology have gotten to know, and they've been impacted by their mentorship. The first of which is Dr. Paul Barish, who most recently passed away. And the second of which is Dr. Roberta Hines. And they were both chairs at Yale. What was so special about them was that they were able to basically create a relationship with their residents and foster their success, foster their development. identify what their special talents and skills were, and really lead them, you know, sort of to the next phase of their profession. So at the end of the day, you know, a large portion of my success and my transition, sort of being openly gay and being a Mexican American, really has its roots in these two very, very significant mentors at Yale. Another common thread that I've really found throughout my career in anesthesiology is that the majority of my mentors have really been women, for whatever reason. It may be that women are not threatened by gay men in the way that many heterosexual men may feel sort of threatened or uncomfortable, or that they may have also experienced, you know, very similar aspects of non-inclusion or outright discrimination. But for me, it's always been this recurring theme that women have sort of become my mentors.
So where did you go after Yale?
When it was time for me to leave Yale, I was really looking for an opportunity where I could develop my sort of business entrepreneurial spirit. And I was looking for opportunities really in sort of the private practice realm. And I was hoping to either return to Florida or to move to Texas where my family was. So once again, sort of the ugly head of discrimination started to rear its head as I started to leave this very protected environment at Yale. I interviewed at multiple groups in North Florida and throughout Texas and just found repetitive environments where they just frankly didn't feel comfortable with having an openly gay man as part of their medical staff. When I confronted many of the physicians who had interviewed me, they just said, well, you know, it's pretty simple. You know, gay men aren't doctors. They can be nurses, but they can't be doctors. When I asked women doctors about it in the same environments, they sort of gave me the answer that, well, you know, we're trying not to upset the apple cart because we have a job, but, you know, it's not that much easier for us either, being, you know, the one woman. So it was really difficult to sort of try to find the right place where I would thrive and be successful. And fortunately, I landed at a very unique opportunity in South Florida in Broward County, Fort Lauderdale. This was really a turning point for me because, you know, all of a sudden, one, I was in an environment that didn't seem to discriminate against me based on my ethnic or racial origins and certainly my sexual orientation. And more importantly, the hospital in which I was working at was extremely open to having people be change agents, to having people sort of identify opportunities where the hospital can serve the community a little better. So that was really a very unique time in my life. I was there for about 10 years. We took that group to sort of its completion, ended up selling it to a third-party venture capital entity. And then I moved on to Los Angeles, where I worked in another private community hospital for 8 years. So now, many years later, after having started my journey in anesthesiology, I'm a partner with the Southern California Permanente Medical Group, which is a part of Kaiser Permanente and the Kaiser Permanente Federation. And one of the things that really attracted me to Kaiser Permanente and our medical group is that the group is extremely progressive in the way it looks at practice, the way it looks at physicians leading the organization, in the way that it places an emphasis on culturally competent care that takes care of people in our community. And so I really have sort of been galvanized by the environment in which I work in and have now been able to sort of rise to becoming the physician champion for LGBTQ care, and I'm the co-chair of the LGBTQ committee. I'm also a physician ambassador for customer and business engagement within the organization, and I'm the leader for the perioperative translational research group. And a lot of that would have really never happened in a lot of other environments or in a lot of other practices without this very formal, intentional, thought-out process regarding equity, inclusion, and diversity. And so now I find myself talking to you all about how I've landed at this place.
Well, that is an incredibly moving story. The different environments that you have had to navigate are incredibly varied. And one question that comes to mind is, have you become more of a cynic, less of a cynic as you've gone through your journey? seeing different cities or locations or practices treat you differently. How has your journey taken you in that regard?
Well, I'm happy to say that I've actually been not really a cynic at all. I'm actually quite hopeful. There's been so much change throughout the United States. And I think that's part of why we're having this conversation today, because the American Society of Anesthesiologists are looking towards the future and looking towards how do we, you know, represent our medical community and the patients that we serve. So I think there's been a lot of evolution. Unfortunately, we still have a lot of work to do, but, you know, I think, you know, we are heading in the right direction and there's a lot of hope.
Well, I'd like to explore your journey just a little bit more. Do you feel over time, as you've gotten more mature and more experienced in your career, do you feel that your comfort level with being openly gay and having to have dealt with diversity issues throughout your career, have you felt that you have grown into being more comfortable in that regard, or has society allowed for that, or is it a combination of things? Or do you feel like nothing really has changed much in either of those factors?
I think that's a really interesting question. I think it's definitely a combination of all of the above. Certainly, I have become, you know, much more comfortable in my own skin, and I am certainly much more forthright and not apologetic for who I am or what I am or where I'm from. And in fact, I'm actually quite proud of my very diverse background and my upbringing and all of my perspectives. I do think that, you know, society has certainly evolved, but it's been a little slow. Social change certainly comes about slowly. I think what's actually happened, though, is that there are more people like me. There are more people who are really no longer afraid to, you know, step into the spotlight, so to speak, and to speak up and to let their voices be heard. And one thing for certain that sort of I've become is I am certainly not shy about knocking on doors and looking for opportunities or looking for someone to be an ally or looking for someone to possibly champion an idea or an endeavor with. Whereas in the past, you know, I might stop at the second door that says no. Whereas now, you know, I might not stop until it's like the 100th door that says no. And to be frank, I usually find somebody who says yes, you know, usually by the 20s, you know, by the 15th or 20th door, I found somebody who is actually, oh, they see my perspective and they've heard something about it before. They, you know, they have some insight about it and they probably agree that something needs to happen. So, you know, I think it's a combination of everything. And it does take people to, you know, put themselves out there to, you know, whether you're confident or not in your own skin, it always requires someone to make, you know, themselves vulnerable, make themselves vulnerable to rejection, make themselves vulnerable to possibly being ostracized or being marginalized, you know, and that's never really fun. But I think certainly as, you know, you have more professional credentials and sort of a reputation that precedes you, those things become a little easier because you become more legitimate. You know, when somebody hears, you know, something from someone who's been the CEO of a corporation running 200 anesthesiologists or who's been, you know, somebody who's been authoring chapters and textbooks and writing, you know, dozens and dozens of manuscripts, they certainly realize it's not just some, you know, one-off kind of harebrained idea. So, you know, I think it's all of that.
Based on what you just said and thinking back to when you were at Brown and you had a very welcoming environment and you had individuals there who were encouraging of you going on to medical school, do you think that without that welcoming environment, you would have still pursued that? How much did that help you in your decision to become a physician?
For me, it was a tremendous, you know, asset. Whether I would have succeeded, you know, in spite of it or despite of it, hard to say, but certainly it made me a lot more successful or a lot more competitive in the pool. It certainly, you know, allowed me to go to a top tier or near top tier medical school. I think one of the things that you really have to call out is that programs like the program that I was part of at Brown called the Health Careers Opportunity Program, those things, they just don't, they're not just things that are done on the fly or they're somebody's, you know, sort of secondhand thought. They're extremely intentional. They're well thought out. They have a vision. They have an operational plan. They have a strategic trajectory. They have, you know, metrics with which they're trying to achieve. And they really are looking to effectuate change. And so a place such as Brown that's so forward thinking and so, you know, intertwined with the education of the undergraduate students, I think is extremely unusual. I don't think that really exists everywhere. But if we fast forward even to now, where we look at organizations, whether they be Fortune 500 organizations or whether they be, you know, organizations in medicine that are successful and that do create trajectories for people to become successful, opportunities and glide paths for people to move into leadership positions, it's extremely intentional. It doesn't happen just by chance. It's happening because people who are current leaders have taken the time to investigate a particular deficiency. They've taken a lot of evaluation and examination to try to determine how to change something that is a recurrent problem.
This is going to be, I think, a common thread throughout this particular series of podcasts, but the idea of perhaps indifference to the problem versus actively identifying it and seeking out solutions. Do you feel that indifference is a greater problem? Perhaps people not intentionally, you know, looking to keep anyone down, but either turning a blind eye or not caring or not choosing to see it versus someone proactively seeking those individuals that may have, unfortunately, feel that they can't achieve what they can because of their personal situation?
Well, I think there's a number of factors that come into play. For many people, there simply is, we'll just call it sort of a blind spot. They may not even, you know, identify or recognize that there is a particular issue at hand. And for right now, we'll just say, you know, there being X number of women leaders, women in leadership positions, or there being X number of underrepresented minorities in the medical community, or there being X number of LGBTQ physicians in the medical community. It may not even occupy sort of a conscious, you know, place in their day-to-day operations. Now, part of what sort of exacerbates that is then, you know, the people or the organization or the infrastructure underneath them also possesses unconscious biases that just tend to sort of amplify and allow that behavior to persist. Until you really get a sort of threshold number of complaints, or there's a threshold number of people who are willing to speak up and make that problem known, and that problem or that issue sort of rises above the level of noise and becomes sort of a galvanizing call to action, do things sort of start to become, you know, sort of realized. I think, you know, much of why we find ourselves today is in this sort of position is the recent events regarding, you know, the murders of multiple Black Americans and the entire Black Lives Matter movement. We find ourselves today now at a point in society where we've risen above sort of the noise. We've risen above the fact that these statistics can no longer be buried. We've sort of risen to the point where it's noticeable and everyone around us notices these things. And whether it's Black Lives Matter or whether it's sex discrimination with regard to leadership positions, or whether it regards to marginalization of LGBTQ physicians or persons in the community, all of this stuff has sort of, you know, risen above that threshold. And now, you know, it's really taking, you know, place front and center for many, many organizations who are, you know, now having to deal with this. And some are dealing with it in a very responsible and intentional way. And they have, they're developing glide paths that will accelerate progress in that area. Others are maybe taking a much more sort of wait and see approach, and it may take longer to effectuate change. But I think, you know, we're at this point now where you know, due to, you know, the internet and Instagram and Twitter and the use of video cams, we're really able to, you know, display, you know, very demonstrably a lot of these types of problems or societal ills, if you will.
It's an unfortunate truth that when we talk about diversity of any kind, we have a tendency to expect those who share the minority status under discussion to educate everyone else. Does that feel like a burden at all to you?
I've never thought of it as a burden. I've always thought of it as basically having the opportunity to tell people a little bit about myself and for them to have a little bit more insight or have them gain a little bit more understanding about who I am and where I'm coming from. The reality is, unless, you know, anybody really speaks up and sort of speaks their experience or, you know, allows their voice to be heard, we really can't expect other people who don't necessarily share the same backgrounds or the same traits or the same experiences to, you know, explicitly understand that. You know, I think that's a big leap of faith for, you know, even the most evolved person with the highest emotional intelligence. That's really a big leap. When I was at Yale, I came out, I was an openly gay man. And at the time, there were no openly gay residents or no openly gay attendings. There was nobody really on, you know, professorial staff in the department. And so, you know, people came to me and they asked me a lot of questions. And a lot of those questions were really uncomfortable. They were really awkward. Some were kind of silly. When you think about it, you almost laugh at how, you know, just kind of trivial they were. But I didn't see it as a burden. I saw it as sort of a way for me to be open and honest with my colleagues. And I took it as, you know, I looked at it as the fact that these people were interested in hearing about me and they were actually interested in trying to learn about me and trying to figure out, you know, how to connect the dots. And I think we sort of all have a responsibility to make ourselves known and make ourselves heard. You know, back in the 1980s, when the AIDS epidemic was really at a sort of a boiling point, there wasn't a lot of governmental action. There weren't many drugs being produced in order to combat AIDS. There were some very sort of, we'll just call them, you know, progressive radical advocacy groups. And one of their slogans really was quite striking. And I think about that slogan to this day. And that slogan, which was by the organization called ACT UP, it was entitled "Silence Equals Death." And what that really meant is that if you stay silent, that at the end of the day, your voice won't be heard and it'll probably lead to your own death because, you know, nobody's listening to your needs. And I always think about that as I kind of meet people or when people sort of don't understand what's going on. If I remain silent and I don't let my voice come through or we don't let the voices of people come through, then inevitably we sort of, you know, we bury them, so to speak. They become dead because we don't hear them. We don't see them. We don't acknowledge them. So I don't see it as a burden. I actually see it as part of our responsibility to society. Part of why we've made so many, you know, advances and gains is because there have been people before me who have really taken it upon themselves to go out of their way, whether they be, you know, Black Americans who have, you know, sat on the bus and refused to be kicked off, or whether they were women who, you know, just kept at it and didn't allow, you know, sex discrimination to obstruct their path to leadership positions, or whether we're LGBTQ people who are marginalized. I think we all have a responsibility to make our presence known and not be silent.
I imagine you've been in situations where you're with a group of people and something is said. They perhaps don't realize that you're gay, and perhaps a jarring comment or a joke or something like that that is instantly visceral and perhaps offensive. And in those situations, if you've ever encountered them, how do you handle those? Just if you could talk a little bit about that kind of a situation.
Yes. And for me personally, I've always sort of tried to take the higher ground. on things like that. Yeah, you know, I'm not a person who confronts people assertively or aggressively, and I've never really felt that that's the best way to build bridges with people. And I've always sort of looked upon that type of interaction when a comment is made or there's a very uncomfortable situation or, you know, something that's even said, like, as you mentioned, that's offensive. I really think about it for a little while. I think, gather my thoughts and maybe even wait a day or, you know, at least a few days, and then go and approach that person in private. And I just try to have a very open conversation, just kind of letting them know how that felt to me, how that was perceived to me, and, you know, if there was any, you know, malicious intent in what they said, or if they even realized if what they were saying was offensive to either me or others in the group. I don't ever see, you know, active assault and confrontation to, you know, be the way out of, or to be the way to solve problems like that. Certainly, you know, we have situations as anesthesiologists where we work in the operating rooms and we hear offensive language. And I think we sometimes have to just call it out right then and there and say, you know, everybody, let's lower the temperature of the conversation in the room, because we're, you know, treading on thin ice here. Sometimes you have to kind of call it out, but you do so in a manner that's professional and also respectful. I think one thing to understand is that, you know, we often ask for zero tolerance, that we're not, you know, that we have zero tolerance for racism, or we have zero tolerance for homophobia. Zero tolerance doesn't mean that you have to completely understand it, or that you have to completely agree with it or endorse it. It just means that you have to acknowledge that we're coming from a different place, and that your behavior or that your language or your actions, you know, in a particular regard will no longer be tolerated. It doesn't mean that we're going to completely, you know, change your mind about how you feel about things. When we sort of start speaking about, you know, we're going to have zero tolerance in the operating room, or we're going to have zero tolerance in society at large, you know, we have to be really, we have to really choose our words carefully, and we have to understand what we really mean by that.
When you've handled situations like that, is there a typical response you receive? Is it usually positive? Maybe certainly in the professional realm, but anywhere.
I found that it's usually very positive. I found usually people are legitimately apologetic, that they've said something that they honestly didn't even think that would be offensive. They usually extend an invitation to sort of learn more about either me or the persons involved or the behavior. I've actually always found most people to take the high road, really. Maybe that's because, you know, I work in a very professional environment, or, you know, the majority of my life, my adult life, has been in, you know, large, you know, metropolitan cities, where I think people, you know, have been very open to change, or, you know, open to certainly seeing other people's viewpoints from different backgrounds. But I've actually never really had an issue with it. I think it's really important, regardless of which side of the sort of the table you're sitting on, is to always, you know, understand that, you know, you should be respectful. You should be try to be compassionate. You should try to be non-assaultive and non-confrontational, and just try to sort of look at the big picture, and also put yourself in their shoes, because I don't necessarily have their perspective, and I'd like to learn about, you know, someone else's perspective of what may have led to those actions or behaviors, or, you know, whatever it was that we are now having a conversation about. And so, you know, part of what I think part of why certain organizations are so successful in advancing, you know, diversity, equity, inclusion, or creating these very progressive sort of workforces or environments, is that they have created safe spaces for conversation, and they've created avenues where people, you know, they're not threatened, or they're not intimidated, or there's no fear of retaliation for bringing these types of things up. But that, I think, is not really the norm. I think certainly many people fear, you know, if they speak up, there will be retaliation, or they fear that something will happen to them, or they'll be passed over for promotion or things like that. So, you know, we still struggle with that. So I think if we take the high road and always try to be respectful, professional, you know, try to be insightful and to try to see the other side of the coin, I think we can certainly, you know, build more bridges than trying to blow them up.
Certainly. Let's steer it just a little bit more towards anesthesiology and healthcare. Let's start with anesthesia. Your fellow anesthesiologists, is there anything you'd like them to know, or what are things that you wish people knew better in our field?
Well, I think anesthesiology is, you know, a very unique specialty because, one, we have very limited, you know, exposure to the patients before we actually anesthetize them. You know, the majority of us spend 10 to 15 minutes of time with a patient. We sort of honestly and frankly admit that the patients don't belong to us and that we're not able to, or we think that we're not able to really impact their care, you know, beyond the sphere of our immediate operating room environment. One of the things that I think it's really important for anesthesiologists to, you know, come to terms with, and there are certainly many leaders in our specialty who have, thought about this, you know, how do we impact care? How do we improve outcomes beyond our immediate area? How do we effectuate change? And the reality is, for us to do that, we have to really step outside of the operating room. We have to be more involved in pre-admission screening and evaluation. We have to be more collaborative and work more closely with the primary care providers and the specialists to which, you know, our patients may belong to, so to speak. Or we may have to work in other environments where we haven't, you know, really had a place. I think one of the things that has been, you know, so uniting about the COVID pandemic is that anesthesiologists have really sort of stepped outside of their traditional box and been deployed into other arenas. They've taken, a leadership role, or they've taken a role in really, you know, stepping to the forefront of managing patients in the intensive care units, especially for people who don't usually work in those settings. They've, you know, worked creatively with engineering and with operations managers to figure out, you know, how to accommodate these patients. And I think what you've really seen is that anesthesiologists do have the capability and the capacity to effectuate change as it pertains to a particular patient in the greater construct of medicine, as opposed to just limiting it to, you know, the few hours that we have in the operating room. So as anesthesiologists, I think, you know, we can continue to sort of extend that to saying, you know what, I think we can make our patients' lives and their healthcare better if we start to consider, you know, how does race, you know, come into the equation? Or how does, you know, there being LGBTQ come into the equation? Or how does, you know, their socioeconomic status come into the equation of improving their care? And what can we do? For me in particular, you know, as a gay man coming of age during the AIDS crisis, and then sort of seeing the impact of the antiretroviral therapy and HIV positive patients arriving in the cardiac operating rooms, I took it upon myself to become an expert in, you know, the management of the HIV patient in the perioperative setting. It's really become something I've become extremely passionate about. It's an area that has not been well explored by our specialty. We've certainly come to understand it a lot better and made a lot more advances about how do we optimally manage HIV positive patients who are undergoing surgical care. And that's just, I think, a small example. I think if every single one of us uses our own particular perspective and background and couples it with something that they're passionate about, we can most definitely effectuate change, you know, outside of our immediate sphere in the operating room. So I think that's really, I think, sort of a call to action for my fellow anesthesiologists is to, you know, step back, see what you can do, you know, to improve the health of everyone in our society or everyone in the healthcare system in which you deliver care, and try to make it better for everybody. Because at the end of the day, that's what, you know, equitable healthcare is all about. It's trying to, you know, eliminate those disparities and trying to make things really, you know, equal for everybody. So everyone has, you know, a good chance at survival or an excellent chance survival, or so that you've optimized outcomes for every single type of patient or patient from every single type of ethnic, background or racial group, and things such as that. So I think that's really, my request and my ask of my fellow community.
I've always felt that we as a specialty have such a unique opportunity, given the short duration we have to spend with our patients typically, not in every realm, but usually, and how much of an impact that short interval can actually make if we proactively address something. And some of the context before I've talked about it has been with the opioid epidemic, and just asking a couple questions can potentially make a difference in someone's life, or discussing the treatment in that regard and how it can play out postoperatively. But you certainly touched on a whole litany of other areas as well that you can make a difference in someone's lifestyle and healthcare. And I agree. I think anesthesiologists certainly are well placed to make a huge difference in a short amount of time in any patient's life.
Absolutely. I definitely agree. I think one of the things that's most wonderful about our specialty is the fact that, we're really the cement or the glue that holds all of the bricks together in the house of medicine. I mean, we are really omnipresent in almost every area. Sometimes we're seen and not heard, and perhaps it's time for us to be more heard, and for us to step up to the plate and sort of start knocking on doors, whether they be on those primary care doors or the specialty doors, or, taking a leap of faith and start evaluating something that has really not been evaluated at all. I think a big example of this is, we know that cardiovascular disease disproportionately, quote, impacts men. Well, we know that because all the research is on men by men. But we have very few leaders in the world of cardiovascular medicine who are women. And so by default, we don't really know a lot about cardiovascular disease, or we know less about that area because there aren't, women looking at that with regards to women. And so, if you just look at something as basic as that, we have so many opportunities in which we can start evaluating things, in partnership with the specialists we work with and our colleagues who have expertise in a wide array of areas. So we need to harness that and use that and allow synergy to sort of come into play. Intentional, well thought out synergy.
Let's talk specifically about the LGBTQ community, as long as we're talking about healthcare disparity. Sometimes, simply because of that acronym, for instance, we homogenize the very diverse community that encompasses. Is that problematic when we discuss the issue of healthcare disparities?
Yes, it's very problematic. I think, it's as problematic as sort of, whether we make a generalization about, women in medicine, or whether we make a generalization about, quote, underrepresented minorities in medicine, those being Native American, Latinx, or Black, and then those who are LGBTQ, the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer community is extremely heterogeneous. And within every one of those letters in the acronym resides another silo of heterogeneity amongst itself. Part of what sort of happened is that a lot of people sort of, have the perception of the LGBTQ community being, a very affluent, cisgendered, white man. And they think, oh, well, all gay men are, cisgendered white men. They're affluent. They live a nice lifestyle, they have good jobs and everything. And I think part of why that's happened is because that's what the media portrays to us, and that's what's comfortable for us. If we just look at, statistics in the LGBTQ community, the vast majority of people who are LGBTQ actually tend to be people of color. They tend to either be Latinx or Black. They're actually not Caucasian, but yet that's sort of the representation we get from the media or from TV. We also know that the obstacles and barriers that reside within the LGBTQ community with regards to healthcare are extremely different. The discrimination that an LGB person receives, while significant, is certainly nowhere near as severe as the sort of obstacles and barriers that a person who's transgendered experience. At Kaiser Permanente, we launched an initiative a number of years ago called the Sexual Orientation and Gender Identity Intake. We refer to it as the SOGI intake system. Part of why we did that was because we wanted to attune our physicians to that very important aspect of a patient's, you know, background. Medical issues, you know, are certainly a consequence of many things, and being a lesbian woman or a gay man or a bisexual person or a transgender person certainly may place you at risk for a number of various, you know, healthcare issues or complexities. And by Kaiser Permanente starting to catalog that and, you know, use that as part of your initial intake or your ongoing intake, it really has allowed us to improve that care that we deliver to LGBTQ people, as well as to sort of, you know, diminish the disparity that exists. Now, certainly Kaiser Permanente is not, it's sort of not an open system. You're not within the system unless you have, you know, Kaiser Permanente insurance. So we're not able to change, you know, everything within society at large, but we're certainly able to optimize it within our insured population. But it has, you know, it really has been noticed, and we have been, I think, leading the way. Amongst other things, the COVID-19 pandemic has really, you know, shed light on the disparities that exist amongst LGBTQ people and people who are of lower socioeconomic means, and certainly people who are Black and Latinx. So the state of California has a Senate bill that specifically asks for the intake of sexual orientation and gender identity for any patient who's being treated for COVID. We're hoping that will, you know, pass into state law, and that all healthcare, you know, providers and institutions will have to start collecting that data, although it's not that easy to necessarily put in place. It certainly is a manner of trying to better understand the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic on this particular population. And it will sort of start leading us in the right direction with regards to that one particular issue. But we have a lot of work to be done. And like many things, part of the reason why those disparities exist in the LGBTQ population is because there aren't as many providers who are comfortable dealing with the population or knowledgeable about the specific issues that may affect the various people in that LGBTQ spectrum. And so it really is a large obstacle to overcome. And certainly even in 10 or 20 years, we've made progress, but it hasn't been nearly as ideal as we would have liked it to be. Certainly having LGBTQ physicians will help, but it can't be just us. You know, we can't improve the healthcare of marginalized persons all on our own. It has to be an effort made by, you know, the entire house of medicine, so to speak.
There's a couple things I want to follow up on with what you just said. Number one, I think it's a point that I think is probably evident to so many people, but probably bears repeating, which is the heterogeneity of many people. And the idea, oftentimes we're bombarded with the concept of everybody being put into one box or a group, or forgetting that the vast majority of us are a makeup of different backgrounds and different experiences, and one, or just the description of one uniform group probably doesn't tell the whole picture of any given individual or patient. I think that's an important point, especially as physicians, to remember that it's the identifiers can be misleading and often simplistic when you're trying to get to know a patient.
I agree with you completely. And I think as anesthesiologists, that problem's compounded because we try to condense, you know, as much information as we can about somebody into, you know, a really short, concise catchphrase, or we create these very, very sort of snapshot views of people without really recognizing or understanding that there may be really a lot of layers to their background that's impacting the care that we're about to deliver. You know, there really is a very large, you know, heterogeneity in what we're doing. Certainly, you know, practicing here in Los Angeles on Sunset Boulevard, you know, I think I treat a facet of the entire world in any one day or any one week. It's just, I think, mind numbing. That may not be the case everywhere, but certainly, you know, we try to develop a better perspective or three dimensionality about how to deliver care, or try to appreciate the nuances of that. Going back to my research in HIV, I think a lot of people, they would just write down HIV positive or, you know, AIDS, and they wouldn't really think too much about, well, that person's on 3 to 5 medications. Any one of those medications may cause multi-organ system, you know, impact or deleterious effects. Those medications have drug-drug interactions with some of our anesthetic agents. And most people just write down HIV AIDS, and that's about it. So I think it's just an example of how, you know, as anesthesiologists, we get into this code of simplifying, you know, our patients as much as we can and not really thinking about how, you know, really nuanced and three-dimensional they are. And so I think going back to one of what we were talking about earlier is that, you know, as anesthesiologists, we have to step back, you know, look at the forest and not the trees, and sort of look at all of this in sort of a much broader context. And then how can we become change agents?
Certainly. What can physicians and maybe specific anesthesiologists do to perhaps overcome the healthcare disparity issue? And anything tangible that people listening right now can do in their practice?
Well, I think, first of all, so much of the change that's occurring within our specialty is really coming via our leadership. It didn't go unnoticed that the ASA really started to take a very, you know, sort of dramatic turn in the way they were, you know, approaching the membership and approaching our presence, you know, in the national sort of medical arena. Up until the time that we started having women presidents, women leading the ASA, you know, recently Dr. Linda Mason from California, currently with Dr. Mary Dale Peterson from Texas, and our president-elect, Dr. Beverly Phillip from Massachusetts. In just 3 years, we're going to have, you know, basically the entire United States being represented by extremely insightful and visionary women. So right off the bat, our specialty and our society is benefiting by a very insightful and intentional leadership structure that is really, I think, becoming aware of the problems that are sort of plaguing us. I think the very first thing that every anesthesiologist group or sort of every department probably needs to do is take time to query their members and say, listen, let's talk about what's bothering you all. Let's talk about, you know, what do you think are the real problems in this group? Or where do you see inequity? Where do you see discrimination occurring, whether that be blatant or unconscious? I think we really have to be honest about creating a safe space for us to have frank conversations and listening to what's happening. As I mentioned earlier, you know, society is at this point where there's so much, you know, there's so much demand for change, and it's sort of risen above the level of noise. But that in society in general, that's occurred, you know, in a country that has 330 million people. But, you know, if we bring that down to our own departments and our own hospitals, you know, maybe there's not as much demand for that, or maybe it hasn't risen above the noise level because we're still not really looking, you know, or we're not seeking to listen to our colleagues, and we're choosing to, you know, just blatantly ignore them. So I think the first thing I would ask is just that we, you know, be mindful that just because you don't recognize the problem doesn't mean it isn't there. It's just that we need to start being intentionally open to listening to it or soliciting it. Once you sort of start that, the floodgates start to open and you start to realize that there's a lot of work to be done. And every institution and every, you know, place of the country sort of has, you know, different issues. They're on different, you know, sort of time points of things that need to change or what are particular priorities. And that's well within the purview to establish that. I think too, we just need to understand that we need to continue to be very mindful that discrimination in the medical workplace and certainly in the anesthesiology workplace continues to occur. We continue to have hostile work environments. There continue to be issues regarding diversity, equity, inclusion, and marginalization of people who aren't necessarily, you know, that of the majority. So we have to really continue to address that. And once again, the ASA has steps to address that. But I think overall, medicine is a little bit behind society at large. And certainly looking at, you know, Fortune 500 companies who have been extremely successful in many of these regards, we need to look at some of their playbooks and try to adapt some of what's, you know, been successfully used and implemented towards, you know, their being so equitable and so sort of state of the art in how they approach their workforce and start adapting it to us.
Well, you touched on the ASA and some of the, you know, the evidence of progress somewhat, but they did put out a statement recently on racism and healthcare disparities. And do you think that was progress, or do you think it was enough progress, or was it just a start? And I just want to get your opinion on that statement.
Yes, actually, I think that's part of why I ended up on your podcast. I saw the statement. Dr. Mary Dale Peterson spoke to the California House of Delegates at our June meeting, and she spoke a little bit, took a little time to talk about that Twitter message and the background, how it came to be, and, you know, sort of readily admitted that, you know, there was a fraction of the society that didn't think we should say anything. There was a fraction of the society that said, you know, we should say something. And then there was a fraction of the society that said we should say much more than what was said. So I think, one, I'm certainly proud that the ASA did say something. Could we have said something more? I think we probably could have. But given the fact that there were so many statements coming out from so many organizations, you know, I think what we did was actually quite good and I think appropriate for us and our presence. I think what it did reveal, more importantly, is that there are a proportion of people in our specialty, in our society, who don't think we should say anything at all. And I think that really points to, you know, an undercurrent of a problem that exists, that there are a percentage of people who don't think that Black lives necessarily matter, or that, you know, underrepresented minorities in medicine don't warrant further evaluation or attention, or that, you know, issues pertaining to LGBTQ status and equitable treatment really reside within the purview of the ASA. And so I think we have to do a little bit more digging, because I think what it did is it sort of exposed the tip of the iceberg and us needing to be a little bit more rapid in what we are going to, you know, design and construct to take us to the next level.
Do you think that people not speaking up, is it indicative of feelings that people just don't want to deal with? Or is it, do you think it's more a result of the environment where people are afraid to say anything because of what might happen if they say anything? In other words, do we, as you just alluded to, perhaps, should we be creating that environment to allow people to have an important dialogue?
I think it's both. I think people haven't really been given an opportunity to speak up. And so when you don't give them an opportunity to speak up or a safe space to speak up, then they won't. I think also a lot of people have seen that when people speak up, you know, they're labeled as, you know, a Pollyanna, they're labeled as a complainer, or they're labeled as a troublemaker. And so when you see one of those two things go down, and then you're thinking about your quote academic career, or you're, you know, trying to climb the leadership ladder, you don't necessarily want to jeopardize, you know, your own professional trajectory. And so people start to recoil. I have a feeling that the ASA got a lot of responses to that. And I think because it finally created a little bit of an opportunity for people to speak up a little bit. And as I was alluding to earlier, and will reiterate again now, is that, you know, if we don't intentionally create safe spaces for people to speak up without fear of retaliation, or without this fear of being, you know, ascribed in a negative way, then we're never really going to make any progress. I think once again, it bears reinforcing is that much of this change that our specialty society has undergone has been under the auspices of our women leadership. And as I alluded to very early in this podcast, my mentors as a Mexican, African, gay man have actually always been women. And so I think women are our allies, and I think they're certainly trying to be more insightful and trying to be more deliberate about looking at the entire picture.
You've said this a couple times now, but important for allies to speak up, correct? Staying silent is part of the problem.
Yeah. You know, I think, you know, it's one thing to allow your voice to be heard. And, you know, let's just say we go through the exercise and your voice is heard, you allow, you know, there's a space for, you know, your story or your journey to be heard, what have you. Nothing really comes of that unless somebody who has a platform that can actually effectuate change picks up on that and then continues to move with it. You know, certainly if you're in the rank and file, one, you don't have the time to do that. Two, you don't have the resources to really put anything in place. And you certainly don't have the authority or the leadership capability to call for it and have it be done. So whether you call them a mentor or whether you call them an ally or whether you call them, you know, a leadership executive sponsor or whether you call it the CEO of a company, it really has to come at some point. It has to come from above and, you know, really be endorsed. And then, you know, when sort of that vision is embraced, then you can operationally start to design it and, you know, then bring it back down. And then, you know, you have this, you know, bi-directional and multi-directional movement in how it gets designed and operationalized and implemented. But, you know, a single voice on the rank and file doesn't usually do anything. And so part of why I'm sitting here before you now chatting with you is I think that, you know, I've been able to effectuate change just in my facility and within the Kaiser Permanente system. I think there's, you know, multiple people who have been able to effectuate change at their state levels and at the national level within, you know, a number of different, you know, platforms. So, you know, we certainly need people, whether they be an ally and look completely different from us or whether they be people like us, we certainly have to have, you know, support and cooperation and legitimization from people who are actually in leadership.
Well, let's end this on a hopeful note. What do you think would be your top action items for the ASA and other medical organizations to advance in terms of anti-discrimination actions or policies or anything?
Sure. Well, first of all, I'm really proud to be a member of the American Society of Anesthesiologists for so many reasons. And I think it's because they have always, you know, tried to take the right path and they've always tried to listen to their constituency and take us down the road that makes us better physicians and better able to deal with our community. So I think, you know, the first thing is I think we need to take the recent Supreme Court ruling that affirms that discrimination on the basis of sex or sexual orientation or gender identity is illegal and it will not be tolerated. You know, there have been many states, many groups, many organizations that have allowed that discrimination to occur explicitly and implicitly, and our society should definitely take a stance towards ensuring that any person who's a member of the American Society of Anesthesiologists not be subjected to that. And it's taken 50 years almost since the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1965 for us to actually get to the point where, you know, we have acknowledged that LGBTQ status and sex in and of itself are, you know, cannot be used to be as discriminatory measures. So I think the ASA needs to really own that. I would certainly like to see the ASA assist, you know, many of the groups and many of the sort of the varying practice environments in creating resources and tools so that we can better, you know, effectuate change. As recently as this week in the ASA Monitor, we saw a really nice sort of diagram as to how you begin to create equity, inclusion, and diversity within your leadership ranks. And certainly we can take the lead on developing the tools and the resources that our physicians and the groups and, you know, the multiple organizations that we work with can start to, you know, distill that out because it really does sort of come from us. But like I said, we can't do it alone. So I would really just, you know, like us to continue to take the lead and step up to the plate. And we have a lot of allies. We have a lot of people who are willing to do the work if you just give them the opportunity. So, you know, just, you know, send the message out. I think the ASA will be overwhelmed with the number of people who will want to get involved. I think lastly is just that we remain intentional in our struggle to continue to speak of this. and to not just give it lip service and not say, well, we have one woman, you know, out of 80 people who is in a leadership position and that should be enough. Or we have one person who's LGBTQ out of 100 people in a leadership position and that should be enough. I think we have to be, you know, extremely, you know, honest and say, no, the ASA and, you know, the entire sort of hierarchy or, you know, the committee structure or, you know, all of the multiple infrastructural levels of the ASA has to more accurately depict, one, the population of physicians at large, and two, the population of patients that we serve. And there just needs to be a little bit more alignment in that. And, you know, those sound like three really big asks, but they're actually, I think we have the resources and we have the intellect and the capacity to do all of that in a very short period of time. If anything, the COVID pandemic has really taught us that we are extremely resilient and we are extremely enabling in coming together and developing tools and developing strategies and treatment things that we would have never thought of, you know, 4 months ago. And yet here we are, you know, revolutionizing, you know, care in the midst of a pandemic.
Well, Dr. Hernandez-Conti, I just want to thank you so much for sharing your story, your insights, your perspective, and for joining us today on the podcast.
Thank you so much. It's really been my pleasure to chat with you today, Dr. Stryker, and I wish everyone well. Stay safe.
You as well. Thank you.
I started to get a little teary.
You're talking through a lot of significant life events, and so it's a lot to go through.
Yeah. Well, thank you for letting me speak. And I'm really excited to hear this entire, you know, podcast series. I think our members are really going to enjoy it. I think it's, you know, the beginning of a very, very unique, you know, collaboration. You know, I think it's important that all the different voices or many of the different voices get heard. I mean, that's kind of all that people are asking is just that they get heard a little bit.
This is Adam Stryker. Thanking everyone for joining us on another episode of ASA Central Line, and we will see you next time.
Subscribe to Central Line today wherever you get your podcasts or visit asahq.org/podcasts for more.